Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Dr. Timothy Shaw. Dr. Shaw has conducted a lot of research on moral injury, which many of us have experienced during our service overseas and in combat. And since war in general and combat specifically can create situations where individuals, the soldiers, and the people who experience it, experience situations that contradict their core values and the things that they truly believe in, service members and veterans who have experienced these things have a higher likelihood of experiencing moral injuries. And so today, Dr. Shaw will help us understand moral injuries, the definition of them, what really encompasses them, and how it contributes to veterans and their overall well-being, and how we can try to work towards avoiding these moral injuries in the future. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Dr. Shaw. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. At the moment, I'm the director of a think tank that has been looking at, for the past 10 years, this idea of moral injury. It's identified, and the field has been in a state of stasis, so to speak, and it has resisted being drawn into maturity by three pillars that currently exist, being a religious pillar, a clinical pillar, and a cultural pillar. And the conversations, or the lexicon of the moral lexicons that they have to talk with and between each other, have not been fully delineated in the academic gaze, unfortunately. So my background has been in philosophy. I wrote a PhD on the ideas of moral injury after the Holocaust. So how the meaninglessness or meaning of suffering really is a big driver of this moral injury and this search for meaning, and how one's virtues then feed back into that search for meaning and can in some circumstances be a terribly compounding psychological forest, which many people find it difficult to emerge from.
Yeah, absolutely. I have had some personal experience with moral injury, and also through this podcast, talking to other people, finding out their own experiences with it. And I think that this is just a very important conversation to have, because honestly, before I started this podcast, the term moral injury didn't even enter my awareness. I didn't even think of it as a thing that we should even be talking about or be aware of. And it wasn't until a conversation that I had on this podcast or someone brought it up, and it just, I had that light bulb moment that went off, and I was like, well, that exactly defines the situation that I had dealt with for so many years. And, you know, I wanted to dig into that even more. And so that's why I'm really excited to have you on and be able to talk more about moral injuries and what they're all about. So before we really dive into everything, I think that it's important to start off with common understanding of topics like this by defining the terms that we're going to use. So you have your own definition of moral injury.
Yes.
Can you tell us what that definition is and where the background is from that, and how that came about?
I'd love to. I would love to claim it as my own definition. Unfortunately, it was coined by a gentleman a lot smarter than myself. In fact, a war veteran himself who came back from war, and I'll tell you a bit about that presently. But the definition that Friedrich Nietzsche has come up with is a disruption to the psyche from a will to truth that has become conscious of itself as a problem in us. So a searching for meaning, a searching by this will to truth. Once you're uncovering a lot of paradoxes and crises and things that aren't really meant to be, if something, this happens, this should happen, and when they don't happen, this will to truth that we have in our contemporary society, as opposed, for example, maybe a few hundred years ago, where if you come back from war and you've killed someone, there is no will to truth because that society deems that person, or you will be rewarded for you killing that person in a religious sense, and this still occurs in some societies. There is no moral injury. You come back you don't delve deeper into it with this will to truth than a cursory religious understanding of it. And these are the understandings that when we look around ourselves in the societies in which now, you know, enlightened suffragists of Western modernity, we find those institutions are starting to disintegrate. And with that disintegration, our will to truth becomes more intense as we try and reconcile and find meaning for some very terrible things that actions that are committed to us and which we commit as well, selves.
Yeah, for sure. And when you have these situations, it can affect the overall well-being of the people experiencing it, right? And I know from personal experience, when I was in Afghanistan, my personal situation was I found myself aiming a rifle at a child. And prior to that moment, I was the type of person who I thought would do anything to protect a child. But then I was put in a situation where I felt the need to be pointing my rifle at this child because I thought he was a threat to some of my other soldiers. And, you know, it just completely changed how I thought about myself. And, you know, that type of injury just took its toll on me and my overall well-being. It just changed my own perception of who I was. And I'm sure my story and my situation is not totally unique. There's other people out there who've done similar things to people while they were deployed. But I'd like to dive in a little bit more to how moral injuries like this can affect the overall well-being of the veterans and the people who experience them.
Let me take it back to how moral injury was experienced by a veteran philosopher, Nietzsche, and then expand out to show how these ideas and how we thought about these ideas can be shown to describe the ideas in contemporary military engagements. Because as you quite rightly mentioned, moral injury, it's now been termed as the signature wound of contemporary war. And just like PTSD in the 70s, where that was the signature wound, moral injury will start with veteran populations. And as you've already seen in America, and we are starting to see here in Australia, it will merge out into society as a whole. But let me get back to Nietzsche. So Nietzsche was a philosopher in Europe, and he was the smartest gentleman that in Europe at the time, in the whole of the continent. He was the youngest professor to be given a full professorship. And he went, and as war was coming to Europe, he had volunteered for military service in Prussia, which is a fancy name for countries close to Russia that became Germany. He volunteered for military service, and he went then into war as a captain and in as a medical orderly to provide care and health to soldiers. Now, it wasn't a typical battle that he fought in. It was a siege where the French were in a town called the Metz. And in this town as well, there were civilian populations, there were refugees, there was food crises. They ended up eating all their horses. When they went into the city, the leaves were there at a certain point because of the extreme shortages and sickness and all these ideas of these humanitarian ideas that were born out in this battle, in a siege battle about, you know, provision of health, provision of food and water. These were the ideas that this philosopher was thinking about and dealing about as he was making sure that his own soldiers were being looked after and healthy, knowing full well that the health and regard of Idrit, of mothers, of families on the other side of the wall was in just as dire need, perhaps even more. So after he got back from this battle, the first thing he did was hand in his citizenship, and he remained a stateless philosopher for the rest of his life. So he turned from volunteering for military service to fighting, well, to being in battle, to coming back to his country and handing back his military, to handing back his citizenship. And he then proceeded to publish his first book. He hadn't published a book before, and this book was called The Birth of Tragedy. Now, The opening lines of The Birth of Tragedy, it's an attempt at self-criticism. So his first book that he published, it was an attempt at self-criticism where he says the main event that has prompted this criticism in myself on my moral ideas is ideas that happen under the walls of the Mets in battle, right? So 10 years, it took him 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, he published a book called The Joyous Wisdom or The Gay Science. And he said that, well, this is a return of virulence for me to once more believe in aims that I had shut off from myself. And on this 10th year that The Joyous Wisdom was published, so a 10-year period between The Birth of Tragedy and The Joyous Wisdom, he had a personal setback and he went into the mountains and he wrote, you know, in an enlightened frenzy, the first bit of this, his magnus opus, which starts like this. When Zarathustra was 30 years old, his age at the time that The Birth of Tragedy was written, was published, he left his home and went to the mountains, which is a metaphor of leaving the ideas of his city and moving into the philosophical mountains to try and understand what this moral injury was. And he stayed in his solitude for 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, he became weary of his wisdom and, like the bee that had gathered too much honey, needs hands outstretched to take it. And he came down and he brought this book with him. Now, this book, called Thus Spake Zarathustra, it's been used by Carl Jung as the basis for his psychotherapy, and was in the back pocket, in fact, of German Christians as they fought in World War I as a replacement to the New Testament. That's how powerful the ideas of this book are. Now, when he finished this book, he came down and he had 40 copies of it, and most of them he gave away, right? He sold 40 copies of it. And then year after year, he produced major works which inform the ideas of our society in which we inhabit. And everyone is had a look at this book to try and find out the hidden ideas in it. And the ideas of this book are made intelligible once you understand that this book is a direct response to the moral injury experienced in war and made sense over 10 years without the aid of a state which he felt that had let him down to put him in a situation like that, and without the aid of understanding a God where he thought to himself, am I doing the right thing? Am I, as a medic, helping these men, am I doing the right thing, knowing full well that there's just as much need in this community as well, and they are our enemy, but what are they our, and why are they our enemy? Right. And that sent him on this idea of this will to truth to really try and nail these ideas down. And that it's my argument that The Birth of Tragedy is perhaps the first modern, even postmodern, account of moral injury. And he and Nietzsche describes this book here. The primary aim of this book is to put every sorrowful one down on firm land and firm legs. And that is the stated aim of this book, as a psychological cure to the changes of the soul. And it's exciting. And it's nice to know for soldiers that they have got a philosopher in their back pocket that went to war, that wasn't happy with these things and bloody well wrote about it, you know?
Right. And so someone who's been there, they've experienced the atrocities of war, the moral conflicts that take place, seeing the other side, you know, the enemy, if you will, the women, the children, those families who are the enemy, seeing them suffer and then questioning, you know, why are they the enemy? You know, why, coming up with all these, I guess, philosophical questions, right? Like trying to make sense of it all. And I think we all sort of experience some of that when we see some of the suffering that takes place. Oh. You know, even in modern day warfare, when you see a village that had a bomb dropped on it and you see the carnage and the wreckage that takes place there, was that necessary? Were those children who were in the line of fire, was that necessary for them to be injured or killed? Like, not all of these things are just questions that pop up in our heads. And I know we end up dealing with veterans who come back and service members who come back from a deployment from combat, and we don't always know what it is that they're dealing with. And it would be nice to be able to assess this moral injury in these people, you know, trying to figure out, is this tied to PTSD? Is it linked? Or how do we know that it is a moral injury that we're dealing with? And, you know, for the loved ones who are experiencing this firsthand at home, someone struggling and kind of grappling with all of this, you know, how can we assess this and determine what it is that we're even dealing with?
In an important way, it is very, you can understand moral injury in the way in which post-traumatic stress disorder has been understood. Because for centuries, if you had a psychological ailment, it would be understood as an abnormal reaction to an abnormal stressor. Now, this put the onus on the sufferer, like saying, I am at fault in some way. Now, with PTSD, PTSD was classified solely in terms of a definitional approach. So any psychological disturbance was seen as a normal reaction to an abnormal stressor. And moral injury will be seen the same way, because in the end, we are all children of the era of humanity and crimes against humanity, and not in the era of God and crimes against God. And we understand our morality and our ethics as people that have grown up with pen pals in Africa, which on the news see starvation and famine, and we've been highly sensitized to these imperatives, even if we do not know it, right? And when you have, and this is, I guess, happening on a religious spectrum as well, when you hear about the Pope talking about Vatican II, and what they're trying to say is realign these values with humanitarian ideas. And all of a sudden in 2018, there was a papal directive, capital punishment is in all circumstances. You cannot justify it. Now, you might rightfully think, hang on a second, did the church just say capital punishment is unjustified? Because for hundreds of years, perhaps there's an argument to be made that they were the original capital punishers, right? The gravitas of the church was the gravitas to say, well, yes, we have a right to put you to death. Now the church is saying, we relinquish that right, because after World War II, guess what the most heinous crimes and heinous criminals were charged with? Not with crimes against God, no. They said, hang on a second, we're not going down this line, because she chokes on her with crime against God. They're going to just flip it around and say, there's a crime against you. Well, our God says that's a crime, and it just keeps on bubbling and keeps on rolling. They said, no, we're going to introduce the charge of genocide to understand the destruction of the nation state. The problem was, of course, is that the Jewish diaspora was a diaspora, not a nation state of peoples. So they said, we're going to make it an even more foundational charge called crimes against humanity. And the birth of crimes against humanity certainly spelled the death of crimes against God. And you have a whole literature after World War II, particularly in Europe, where they had killing factories of humans, saying, hang on a second, you know, God is like, particularly there was some very famous existential philosophers that said, we need to understand how to think about what has happened, because our idea that we didn't deserve it. We can't say that our ancestors deserved it. There's no way in which this could be justified. And it can't be justified because of the crime against the humanity of a human that lives underneath religion. And these big ideas that are now circulating, especially Western societies, because of these ideas of universal suffrage that have permeated through as our societies have made a very painful psychological break from religious ideas, because it is a painful break to not have those meanings as a crutch, right? You can easily say, well, God said it's the right thing to do it, and God said this. But if you are then separating these ideas out and you are starting to really think about them, the science calls it a state of psychic grace for one's suffering. And we are losing a state of psychic grace in relation to our suffering because we have no meaning for it. And that when we are searching desperately for the meaning of suffering that is occasioned from seeing these atrocities, and perhaps the meaning that we're looking for is the meaning of why these atrocities or why these terrible things are happening in our world when we can prevent them.
Right. And so we have an interesting relationship here because you're talking about how that relationship with crimes against God and the crimes against humanity, that switch that took place, we now have different ways of thinking about things that people years and years ago didn't really think about things in that way, right? And so now we have people coming back and we're concerned with these crimes against humanity and looking at the pain and the suffering. And like you said, did we have the ability to prevent some of this stuff from happening? And so in some cases, the answer is absolutely yes. And did we sit back and just watch it happen? And did it?
It is awful. Yeah. So you can really get to the nub of, how do we understand ourselves as vessels of goodness? And are we the goodness that we understand? And when these things get rattled within, maybe we aren't good. Maybe we do. And our ideas of our virtues, which are orientated to a goodness. So we can't go down to the supermarket and buy a cup of sacrifice. No. These ideas are orientated to these analogical ideas that live beyond in as ideas. And we align ourselves to these ideas. And Nietzsche says, well, hang on a second. Not only do we align ourselves to these ideas, but we sacrifice, for example, our bestial nature. So how do you get the virtue of sacrifice in all these ideas? Well, you know, you get them from sacrificing like your natures as you were brought up in society. You might have the nature to grab something and eat it and all of it and not wait and not allow someone else to have it first. But through the honing of learning not to do that, you then turn your want of snatching it into the virtue of not snatching it. And then you align your virtue as a not snatcher because you wanted to snatch it. Right. And that's how he sees that virtues are drawn up through. And once those start ideas of oneself also start crumbling and coupled with, you know, I'm working with veterans that are homeless and substance abusive, and coupled with those things, you have terrible outcomes.
Yeah, for sure. And when you have the people who are, like you said, brought up in a way that certain social norms, not killing people and, you know, things like that, right? I mean, that's a pretty basic one that transcends most societies. Yeah, exactly. You just don't do that. And then you're put in a situation where you have to. It's part of your, not only is it part of your job, but it's a requirement for you to continue living because there's somebody else out there who wants you dead. And now you have to do this thing that for years and years, decades, you have thought that you're not that person. You're not the person who goes and kills people. And now here you are, and you're the person who just killed somebody. And how, and all of that, like you said, it's going to come crumbling down. And who are you now?
What kind of person are you?
Right.
Yeah.
And I can see how these moral injuries could, you know, just be affecting everything that you believe about yourself and, you know, possibly even being linked to things like the veteran suicide crisis that we have.
Not only the veterans.
Yeah. Veteran suicide is one of the primary reasons why I started this podcast to help veterans learn about the things that they're going through, learn about the resources that are available and realize that they're not alone in whatever it is that they're going through. And so I'm interested to know about how the three pillars that you were talking about in society, how we can sometimes maybe compound moral injury and inadvertently contribute to this crisis that we're seeing in the veteran community.
Sure. With moral injury, it's very difficult because it's very difficult. The person sitting next to you on the bus, the person serving you at the store, it's not something that's visible and it's not something that society finds is very easy to recognize. So a lot of the time, and what Friedrich Nietzsche uses as a metaphor, he says, look, imagine everyone starts off as a cow in a herd. And, you know, a cow is very content in a way, like it has meaning for its suffering. If something happens, it can find meaning in its suffering because it's not an extreme event. So you go down and you get, you know, if a tree falls on you and you break your arm, it's meeting on that stuff just because the tree fell on you, but it doesn't question your whole idea about like, why am I, it's not a psychological internal suffering, which really occurs when you've been let down or something has occurred where you have to start to really delve into it. Because you don't delve into the tree falls down, or, you know, it's the force of nature, right? You don't really look any deeper. Your suffering has meaning. I know it's a physical suffering, but once you had moral injury, you're more like a camel, and a camel is something that is laden with all these ideas of a cow, and but it's by itself and it's tracking out into the desert, and it's by itself, and it's trying to make sense of these meaning structures in relation to itself. Now, how that's done is, or, you know, normally these sort of ideas is throughout history has been, you know, we will be better people and we are going to wait for a second coming into, you know, as Christian people, we are, you know, we will do, because for a Christian, it's always self-introspection. Can I do better? Should I have done better? You know, like a cow that is chewing these ideas, the 10 thou shalt not. It's always trying to think, have I done the right thing? Right? Once you realize that you're really, and this not sure, and you're really looking with a will to truth that is now starting to become conscious of itself as a problem in us, as a moral injury, and you're thinking, oh my God, what's going on? And these sort of things, they're all sort of crumbling. A way in which it becomes very important to somehow to try and stabilize these things. What we're seeing at the moment is an attempt to link meaning with Eastern religions and Eastern philosophies. So you'll see a lot of, you know, yoga or meditation or these ideas which are there to sort of to find some form of inner peace through when you have these moral injuries. But Nietzsche, he says, hang on a second, that's all well and good, but why don't we try and turn these moral injuries into something that's not an injury and into something that we're all looking for the meaning of why we are suffering, and instead of right-thinking rigor to make sure, well, how are we doing the right thing and that's causing us injuries, let's change that right-thinking rigor into right-acting rigor, and through the creation of activity and through what he calls a will to power that occurs after a will to truth, the suffering, the moral suffering, and I've seen this in many veterans, that once they have got an idea about, they might have felt shit about something, and possibly with yourself, you know, you've started a podcast, and that will to power of, you know, getting behind something that you're starting to really believe in and you want to make a difference, that is better than any band-aid you can do, because it puts it away, and you're now creating your own thing that is drawing you out of that moral injury, as you create new ideas and new ways of thinking about what's occurred.
That's an interesting way to look at it too, because it's really finding that sense of purpose, sense of meaning in not only just the suffering that you're experiencing, but in your life in general. Because as you're coming out of the military service, you have this change in who you are. You were a service member, you were a soldier who was serving your country, and that's a big part of who you were at that point. But then there's that shift and you turn into this veteran, and now who are you? Now what is the meaning and the purpose behind everything that you had just done for however many years that you had served and all the combat deployments maybe that you've been on and everything? What's the meaning behind all of that, and how can you do something good with that, right?
Well, I mean, you know, people, World War II veterans didn't have to ask that question, right? Because the meaning of World War II was stamped, signed, sealed, delivered. Veterans after Vietnam, they had to ask that question, right? And you could argue that we are stuck still in this idea of World War II. I heard a statistic that the U.S. government is still printing, is still presenting medals that were printed out during World War II. And they still such a big stockpile of these medals, these purple hearts, for bravery in combat. They weren't used, right? So we're still on this outdated mode of understanding ourselves in relation to the really tremendous things of World War II and Jesus, they were called the greatest generation, were all commemorative days that very focused on World War I or World War II. Particularly here in Australia, we have World War I as a very big central pillar to our understanding of ourselves. But when you shit, but it will be the case that, and it is the case that there are no, the, those veteran populations, they're dying. And what did they fight for? And now what are contemporary soldiers fighting for? What we go to war for is an incredibly important idea nowadays. And to think about this idea in isolation from this burgeoning will to power that occurred after World War II of all these humanitarian institutions. I mean, we think that, you know, that this is normal. It is an explosion of humanitarian institutions post-World War II. And while we think that, you know, they can be better, we have to, you know, compared to before 1945, you know, it's exponential. And that is the fastest horse in the race. That is what all countries should be getting behind, whether or not it's through ideas such as the International Criminal Court, which use those values in terms of understanding, you know, what is acceptable? How do we understand wartime action and reprimand wartime action? And I note that a lot of the major powers are not signatories to the International Criminal Court, but guess who is? Guess who's driving it? Germany. And, you know, just like, you know, that must tell you something, I'd imagine. So, you know, you can wait till the recall on it for a while, but the main take home is if you're going in and then you've seen it in Vietnam, if you're going in to fight for an ideology, it's not going to work psychologically for your soldiers. If you need to be fighting for a hard and fast humanitarian issue at a very important level, because when you come back, you want to, rightly, and you deserve it. Every soldier deserves to have something, to be asked to fight for something that they can be proud of and that their country can clearly enunciate. And if you can't clearly enunciate it, and if you've got, you know, September 11 hearings that are going to go on for another 20 years because you can't use information because it's extracted in black sites, if you can't make sense of these big campaigns that you're committing the minds of your soldiers to, you really have to think about the sanity of those campaigns.
Yeah, that's true. And when you have someone who is being asked to go do something and you can't wrap your head around the why, what's the meaning behind this, and the atrocities that occur seem that just that much worse, because then you start to wonder, did this even have to happen? Why are we even here? You know, that stuff. And I know these questions were asked in Vietnam era when people were going to fight for, like you said, an ideology. And they didn't really understand what it is that they're doing. And so, of course, that's going to have an impact on the people who served over there, because they're not really understanding what the whole purpose was for the war. You know, fortunately for this generation, we did have, you know, a reason for going into Afghanistan after 9/11. And it was, you know, especially in the early years, right after 9/11, it was, okay, we're going to get revenge for payback or whatever. And like, that's the reason. And you can get behind that, because when you see planes crashing into buildings in your cities and people dying by the thousands, do you want to go and fight back for that? And that is something that I think, you know, you can definitely get behind. But years later, you start to wonder, is that really what we're still fighting for? Or, you know, what we're fighting for, you know? And I'm sure people along the way have questioned that and probably contributed to some of that moral injury that they were experiencing, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that one of the ways to avoid moral injuries in the future, I would imagine, is making sure that there is a purpose behind what it is that you're asking.
Correct. Definitely. Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, it's a crucial thing. It's a very difficult it's very difficult to treat it after it's been occasioned. It's hard to prevent it. It's hard to prevent in any case. It's even harder to treat and harder to get wrap your head around when, for a start, it's hard to even understand what the concept is, because there were no psychologists and there were no clinicians a few hundred years ago. There was a different society, and now moral injury tracks the suffrages of a society just as closely as anything else. And it represents a link between the psychologies of communities in those societies and what they've been asked to do, and how those communities understand the meaning of what they've been, of what people have been asked to do. It is a delineation of meaning. The trauma, the post-traumatic trauma, or the secondary, and I hesitate to call them secondary, but there is the split between the trauma or a post-traumatic stress idea and problem and decaying meaning structures. One, you can say, is if you keep looking at it, one is like, you might not be able to look at the other one, but you can start to investigate moral injury. It's very hard, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's very hard to talk about without a medical background or without the ideas that post-traumatic stress disorder has been talked about. Moral injury is very hard to talk about without understanding the contemporary ideas of modernity and how these have come into fruition. And without them, it's just like not having, those are the DSM, that is the DSM of moral injury, having that context. And without that context, very difficult to talk about. I would almost hesitate to say impossible to talk about.
Right. And when you look at two nearly identical situations that might take place in combat, for example, because I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, and you put them in two different time periods, you could have the same soldier who was in one time period and another soldier who was in a different time period experiencing the same thing. They could have two different outcomes in terms of what their moral, the level of injury that they receive from that because of their own perceptions and their own beliefs of themselves and what society looks at them as. You know, are you a hero for committing this act, or are you a monster for committing this act? And that's going to change your perception of who you are and how society is going to perceive you too, right?
There are new mythologies. It was the Superman. The first Superman comic was minted in just before the start of the Second World War. And Superman is an idea of the idea of nature having a man as his. I mean, you can't imagine Superman in heaven or hell. And if you believe in Superman, or if your mythologies of what is good is like a Superman good, so someone that, you know, works in a newspaper and, you know, battles right and wrong. But, you know that at a click of his finger, he could go into his post box, head over to Africa, drill 1,000 wells in a minute, come back before lunch. You know what I mean? What is it? The mythologies of Superman and superheroes, they are still like, you know, avenging. But, you know, you might like to say, Superman, why are you wasting your time, like, you know, hitting on Lois Lane when, you know, you could be doing, you know, doing that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's a good question to ask, because where do we find the meaning of what it is? And if you don't ask those questions, do they then just crumble into what this antagonist, I'm in the right and you're in the wrong, and we trade blows after that, instead of saying, I'm in the right and I know what's right, so I'm going to fix some things that are wrong.
You know, I've never thought of it like that, specifically talking about Superman and other, you know, comics and superheroes and all that kind of stuff. But man, Superman's not living up to his potential. Now that I'm thinking about it, right? Man, this has given me a lot to think about. I'm sure it's given the audience a lot to think about as well, the listeners here. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. I'm sure we could continue this conversation for hours, but I know you're a busy guy and you have things to get to. So I want to give you the opportunity to end out with where people can go to either get in touch with you or find out more about your research and the things that you've come up with through your research and your studies on moral injuries.
Of course. I've got a think tank, which is connected with some, pleasure to say it, some sitting US congressmen. So we are really engaged in this project. I've got a website called greatphilosophicalproblems.com where you can find out a bit more. And I've got and if you'd like a chat or anything, I've got a 1-800 number it would be a real pleasure to talk about these ideas. And I will have any engagement whatsoever. And there's no, I put anything aside, like even if you just want to call up and just talk about some of these ideas, it's a pleasure to do so, to anyone that, any of your listeners, it would be a real pleasure.
Well, great. And I will have links to your website and the stuff in the show notes. So anyone who's looking to get in touch and just maybe even just have a conversation about some of the stuff that we talked about, or even other things that might come up through the course of your listening to this, you might have other ideas that have come up. Feel free to reach out. And then I'm glad to be able to offer this to the listeners. But again, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and really challenging kind of some of the things that I've been thinking about as far as moral injuries, and really opening up my eyes to different ways of thinking about moral injuries and what they actually mean to us as veterans and the community that we serve in. So thank you again for
your time. It's been a great pleasure. Great pleasure. Very welcome.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.